I guess I was just a bit struggling with this whole identity of being a composer. And what does it mean that you are successful in the sense that you have many performances, or does it mean that you are just reflecting very much on what you want to do and but not really getting it out into the world? It's always this tension, you know, between I don't know, the idealistic conception of what a composer is and what you actually are in your personal life situation. Is always there's always some kind of duality, in my opinion. Traditional notion of composition is just broken up so much. I mean, basically you're a composer if you can do anything in Ableton Live or something. There's not a sense of, you don't live your life in a certain way, you don't approach music in a certain way, which is I think probably a challenge for people who went to classical studies, because they still have this sense of inheritance from earlier composers who thought differently. You know, it's a lot of things to think about. I just kind of chose to be a composer. I didn't really see any signs that I had talent for it. I kind of decided that I had talent, which I also think is necessary a lot. You have to decide in a way. I don't mind that there's certain things I don't know how will work. It's part of taking a risk. Risk taking is a big part of my work.
Herzlich willkommen zu Weites Feld, dem Podcast für klassische Musiker auf der Suche nach Inspiration und neuen Wegen. Mein Name ist Max Gärtner und ich treffe mich mit Musikschaffenden, die mit einer klassischen Ausbildung begonnen haben und unkonventionelle Wege gegangen sind, um ihre ganz eigene Idee einer Karriere im Musikbusiness zu leben. Gemeinsam versuchen wir herauszufinden, worauf es bei einer Karriere als Profimusiker ankommt, wie man als Freelancer die richtige Work-Life-Balance findet und sich selbst dabei immer treu bleibt. Für die aktuelle Folge von Weites Feld bin ich der Sommerhitze hier mal kurz entflohen und bin nach Dänemark gereist. Im Hafen von Kopenhagen habe ich unter freiem Himmel bei Sonnenschein und angenehmen 23, 24 Grad den Komponisten Simon Löffler getroffen. Simon hat in Kopenhagen, Aarhus und Berlin Komposition studiert und lehrt mittlerweile an der Royal Danish Academy of Music. Seine Stücke werden international aufgeführt und er hat zahlreiche Auftragskompositionen für namhafte Ensembles geschrieben. Ich habe kürzlich ein Stück von ihm in einem Konzert gespielt und falls ihr da auf meinem Instagram-Channel das ein oder andere Video gesehen habt, ist euch bestimmt aufgefallen, dass Simon nicht nur total interessante Stücke komponiert, sondern dass er auch gleichzeitig häufig extra für jedes Stück ein Instrument entwickelt und das tatsächlich auch selbst baut. Wenn man also das ein oder andere Stück von ihm aufführt, dann muss man nicht nur die Partitur bestellen, sondern es kommen gleich ein, zwei Cases mit, in denen das jeweilige Instrument transportiert wird. Wir haben im Interview darüber gesprochen, wie er damals nach knapp bestandener Aufnahmeprüfung den Mut nicht verloren hat und es über die Jahre geschafft hat, zum international renommierten Komponisten zu werden, ob es wichtiger ist, sich persönlich weiterzuentwickeln oder pausenlos nur Output zu kreieren, um erfolgreich zu werden. Er hat von dem ganz anderen Weg erzählt, den er in Zukunft gerne bei seinen Stücken gehen möchte. Und da er zum Zeitpunkt unseres Interviews die Koffer eigentlich schon gepackt hatte, hat er auch gleich verraten, wo die Reise hingeht, nämlich nach Oslo in Norwegen, wo Simon ab sofort eine Doktorandenstelle hat, um dort seine Dissertation zu verfassen. Worum es in seiner Doktorarbeit so genau geht und wie er und wie sich sein Leben als Komponist so im Alltag gestaltet, dazu jetzt mehr im Podcast. Viel Spaß! So, hello Simon, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Max.
Thanks for taking some time. We're sitting here at the beautiful port of Copenhagen. As we found out some minutes ago, we could have met at Hans Eisler Berlin, but you left some years before I started my first percussion studies there, right?
Yes, I was only there 1 year, from 2006 to 2007.
Yes.
I actually wanted to stay. I applied to study in UDK, Universität der Kunst, and I got in, but something drew me away from Berlin again, so I went back to Copenhagen in 2007.
But before you came to Berlin, you started also your studies here in Copenhagen, and maybe one step earlier, how
was your first step into music in general? I mean, did you start playing instruments as a child or something like that?
I went to a school which is quite known in Denmark called St. Annie. And St. Annie has the Royal Danish, what do you call it, choir or something, that educates boys to sing in the main dome of Copenhagen every Sunday. So you get a lot of music teaching there, voice teaching, but also ear training and even theory. It's a very old-fashioned school, but also a very serious place. A lot of composers and musicians in Denmark, they come from that school originally. So I went there, and that was actually very early. That was the fourth grade or so. And since then, I think music was really just the main thing in my life, actually. On and off.
And at what age have you been in this choir around?
So you enter in the third grade, so that would be, oh my gosh, what are you, 12 or so?
Okay.
Maybe a little bit less, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also play piano and drums even and stuff, I guess. Yeah.
And then after finishing your school, did you know directly, okay, after school, I want to apply for the composition studies at the academy, or?
No, I went to high school and I did not know anything about what my plans in life was. And I went on an exchange year in Houston, Texas. I did not decide to go to Houston, Texas, but you couldn't really decide where. So it was like this rotary exchange thing. So I stayed in Houston, Texas for a year in high school. And I'm not sure exactly what happened, but I started to compose music. Maybe I felt a little bit isolated over there, I'm not sure. This social atmosphere in Houston, Texas, United States, is very different from Denmark. I was in a high school with maybe 4,000 students, which was very alien to me. But anyway, my way of channeling maybe a sense of isolation was going back to music and then figuring that I might as well write music. That was somehow my rationale, was that writing music was somehow the most I don't know, idealistic thing you could do with music.
So that was really the first time you got into writing music?
Yes.
Okay. And from then on, you figured out that this part of think worked for you, and you wrote music more and more, or how went it on?
I guess it didn't really work for me as such. I mean, I got a teacher when I got back to Copenhagen, and I applied for the conservatory, but the entrance exam went very badly, and I was told that I would not get in. So it was just I just kind of chose to be a composer. I didn't really see any signs that I had talent for it. I kind of decided that I had talent, which I also think is necessary a lot. You have to decide in a way.
You need much self-confidence maybe as a composer, right?
Yeah, you need a certain sense of belonging to that way of living, because you know, you work alone, and at least you don't have to work alone. You can of course collaborate, but there's a lot of finding ideas somewhere in yourself, you know. It's a lot of working with yourself in some sense. So it's a specific way of working. But then, contrary to what I was told, I did get in, actually. I got in when I was 20. And then from then on, it just kind of took its own path. Yeah.
And then you didn't make the entrance exam at the first time?
I was told that I wouldn't get in. They and I was actually told very, very bluntly that they didn't think I had a lot of talent. It's maybe very
angry. A shame for them.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, but somehow I got in anyway on somebody else's having other plans than conservatory or something. I was very lucky.
Okay, so a place got free and you got the place.
Yes.
Joining maybe the waiting list before. And
something like this, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And from then on, you started your compositional studies?
Yes.
And how did that went on? You got to know your first teacher there, or did you know him before? No.
I did not know Hans Abrahamsen beforehand. I got him in my first year. We had two teachers at the same time. So I started with Hans. I don't know if you know Hans. He's very famous for writing Schnee, and let me tell you, and he's a really great composer. And after, I think, the first year, I had there was a new professor, which is Ben Sørensen, who's also a really, really, really good teacher for me. And that kind of took its own path. And then after 5 years, I had Simonsen Andersen for 1 year. And in between, in this period, I was in Berlin for 1 year, and I was also eventually in Brussels for 1 year. So I actually studied with a lot of people.
That was the thing I was thinking about. You had really many teachers at many different places. Thinking about studying an instrument. I mean, of course, often you do, I don't know, your bachelor's degree at one place and your master's degree in another place, and you have two or maybe three teachers, but not that much in one during one study time of one person. Is this a thing that many composers do, to study on different places with different persons?
I assume so, but I think in Denmark in particular, it's quite open in that sense. Even now in Copenhagen, where I teach today, people always have two teachers at the same time, and they often change just to get more varied input. Whereas I had a feeling when I was in Berlin, for instance, that it's very based on the professor at the place, you know, and he performs his own school and his own ideology and things. Maybe it's different today, I don't know. But I think it's a Danish thing to be very flexible in that sense, yeah.
And was it like, I mean, of course you composed your pieces during your studies, but when was the moment you tried to take the first steps into maybe some kind of working life as a composer? I mean, when has been the maybe first piece that was commissioned by somebody, or, you know, how did you get your first steps into the business?
After the 5 years of conservatory, I actually figured I'm just going to be a freelance composer now, and it didn't really work for me. I didn't have any commissions, and I was working as a sound engineer in a rock club, which was quite hard, and I also was a bartender, and nothing really materialized, I think, for me. And then I went to study with Simon in the postgraduate program in Aarhus. And I went to Brussels, and in that period of the 2 years of this postgraduate study, somehow I became more seeking out connections with people, and also becoming more traveling and international. And I think I went to Darmstadt for the first time. And then I just slowly got soaked into new music somehow. But I couldn't say there was a defining moment as such, no.
So in the first period of being a freelancer, how was your working daily life? I mean, you were living in Copenhagen?
Yes.
And you wrote pieces, and where, I mean, as a composer, where do you try to get your pieces maybe performed or something, if you're not like internationally connected?
So just in Denmark, I guess, there's a few ensembles and a few festivals. And I might have had a commission or two in this time in between my two study periods. So it wasn't completely empty, but generally speaking, I was just a bit struggling with this whole identity of being a composer. And what is it? Does it mean that you are successful in the sense that you have many performances, or does it mean that you are just reflecting very much on what you want to do but not really getting it out into the world? It's always this tension, you know, between the idealistic conception of what a composer is and what you actually are in your personal life situation. Is always there's always some kind of duality, in my opinion.
How is it about this thing, what a composer is, idealistic?
Well, it's just like the traditional notion of composition is just broken up so much. I mean, you basically, you're a composer if you can do anything in Ableton Live or something. There's not a sense of, you don't live your life in a certain way, you don't approach music in a certain way. Which is, I think, probably a challenge for people who went to classical studies because they still have this sense of inheritance from I don't know, from earlier composers who thought differently. And, you know, it's a lot of things to think about when you're young. And I'm not saying I'm old, but when you're young and have to find your way. Yeah.
Compared with, if we think about maybe today's instrumentalists in classical music, if we compare it to what you said before about the composer's thing and how to develop over years, it seems like the instrumentalists are developing very early today. So maybe you are, you know, like kind of genius at the age of 10, and then you got to do some competitions and then you study and all went very fast. And then you're thrown into the concert market and you're mid of your 20s and you have the feeling that you have built a very nice, I don't know, mechanic musician, you know, that can play everything. But maybe the part of thinking and developing the personality and the, you know, thoughts is missing a bit. How is this maybe different in the way of becoming a composer?
I meet wonderfully talented people, composition students who are 17, and I meet as talented people who are 47. I mean, in my opinion, talent is not about age, but it's often misconceived as such. Of course, as with musicians, there's a certain kind of tactility that is very difficult to develop that later on. It's just the way the brain works. But with composition, there's as much creativity and openness involved that you can, that age, in my opinion, is not a radical factor as such. Yeah. I actually think you can sometimes be, I think I started maybe a little bit too early. I went to conservatory when I was 20. And it was quite difficult actually. Just
seen from today, maybe if some guys listen to the podcast and thinking about studying composition or something, would you recommend to start the studies directly after finishing the school, or maybe take some time, or?
It completely depends. For me, it was a shyness factor. I think just this thing of being performed was very conflictuous for me personally. But you, people are different in that sense. People are different. So no, I don't recommend anything such.
If we look on the life of maybe a contemporary composer, you talked about you were working also as a sound engineer, and maybe some other composers are also having different jobs, maybe as a teacher in musicology or something like this. Is it very hard to live from the work as a contemporary composer? I mean, being performed, getting money out of things?
Yeah, I know very few people who can make a living just as a composer. I actually don't know any.
Really? Okay, so what else, I mean, around composing, do they do?
So they teach, or they sing in the church, or they, let's say, they are critics, they write, or they have something completely different. They are, as I was, a bartender, or they run the mail. Like, it's many different things. Yeah. There's no standard way of being a composer, at least not in Denmark. Mm.
I mean, today, you know, you have Skype or you have the internet or something like this, but also it takes some time, I think. You have to exchange with musicians that play your pieces. You have some pieces that have to be performed with you being part of the ensemble. And also your pieces are often, one that wants to perform your pieces needs to know very exact technical details, maybe to build a setup or something like this. Does it take lots of time to get in touch with the musicians around the world that perform your pieces, and also maybe instrumentalists that are close to you when you develop new pieces?
Very much. The dialogue, not only in performing a finished piece, but also in developing a new piece, it revolves very much around finding pragmatic solutions to sometimes very technical problems. So that's probably half my time spent being in dialogue with the colleagues, absolutely. And it doesn't really help online because, I don't know, for instance, in a piece such as E that you performed yourself, there's just so many things that you can't really explain verbally. You have to just have it in your hands and then you see it maybe pretty clearly. So it's a bit like you should explain somebody how to play the piano, you know, they didn't try it in before, it's impossible. You have to, you have to have a hands-on thing, approach with it. Yeah.
Many of your pieces contain of very specific built setups, many electric things, lights, something like this. Was it like you had something in your mind and you knew you have to build this kind of setup to realize it? Or was it like you were trying with different things and somehow you found out, okay, maybe the classical instruments are not working for your compositional ideas in some way, and you have to search for another possibility?
Yeah, it started very top down, so to speak. I was really kind of bored with the way classical instruments embody some kind of very practical, very rational approach to body movements. If you think of a piano, you have everything at your fingertips, and everything else about the body, except for maybe the foot on the foot pedal, is kind of passive. The same way when you play the violin, everything happens at the edge of your fingers, you know, and everything else is kind of pacified, which is, from a practical point of view, amazing that you can achieve that. But I'm more interested in actually in the body movement than I am in the, or was actually, was more interested in how the body moves rather than the specificities of the music for a long period. So I decided to make instruments that endorse a certain kind of movement pattern. Most of my pieces are actually based on how to explore the movement of certain body parts rather than, and then the music is somehow developed as an extension of that.
To develop such instruments, I mean, I assume you need some space because you're not having everything in your head and then you build it one time and then you send the setup around the world. It maybe needs some time of experimenting with lights, with the controllers, how to build the controllers. Do you have a workshop or something or a studio where you try out these things, or how do you do that?
No, unfortunately, I everything is kind of developed just before a premiere, and then I spend the next years revising the piece until it works according to my conception. No, there's always a time pressure and very much a financial pressure in developing these things. So it takes me quite a while, and it takes me also quite a few disaster performances to get things right, but that's just the way it happened. But recently I got more pragmatic, and things work more or less from the beginning the way I wanted it. But it's, you know, I don't mind that there's certain things I don't know how will work. It's part of taking a risk. Risk taking is a big part of my work. Well, it's not an aesthetic that I embrace, but it's a byproduct that I accept. So that's just the way it is. Just the way it is. But it was much more beforehand. It's much less now, I think. So yeah, there was also really a learning period. I'm actually not making that many instruments anymore. I'm trying to get away from it. I'm stripping away just to the body, you know. So it was, I see my machines, if I may say so, as a limited period of my work.
You are now heading to Oslo very soon to have a PhD time there, and talking about you're now more into focusing on the body, maybe you can tell something about what about your PhD is.
I'm very keen on exploring the behavior and the music making of animals, and I'm very keen on creating taking such a civilized thing as the stage in music, which is really just a podium on which you can see things from very far away, and making that into a territory, creating kind of a way of making music that is based on this is my life, this little territorial habitat, and exploring the way animals they inhabit a territory and how they communicate with people within the territory, and also with or against things outside of the territory, and essentially exploring animal expression and trying to transpose that onto a musical, a human behavior. You know, there's a ton of instances where people have, composers have imitated animal sounds in their music, but I'm interested more in the concept of becoming an animal. And what does it mean physically? For instance, one of the defining factors for us humans, also for musicians, is the hands and the way the thumb is able to go in opposition to the rest of the four fingers to create a grip and to create many, many nuances of grabbing onto something in the world. And many animals don't have that. Even chimpanzees don't have that because they don't have a dexterity. The thumb is not flexible. It can only bend the same way as the other fingers on the chimpanzees. So I'm interested in asking what happens if you take the hand away? And what happens if you don't have two legs, but if you have four legs or something? So to put yourself in the position of an animal and then exploring how can you make music from that perspective. So this act of becoming, in a very concrete sense, is my research topic. And I made a bird piece the last year, which is far from finished, but which I will finish eventually, where you have an extended mouth, you have an extended hand as wings, and you move your head as a bird does in a circular manner, and these things. So that's my interest right now.
So, and if we think about the performance situation of such a piece, it's more like you are figuring out how it is to be maybe becoming a bird and make sounds and music with your own body, or you are like in the body of a bird, you are controlling other instruments.
No instruments. The body is the instrument, as far as I'm. I think right now, but I mean, of course, there will be certain artistic freedom choices naturally. But the concept is, for me at least, to the act of becoming someone else, and to break down the barrier between the human and the animal, which I think is also very relevant in today's world, where the human activity is just kind of, to me, just too much. I mean, we somehow just eat up the planet, you know, and just to take a different perspective where we are the other. And how do we then behave with all the limitations that implies? That's my philosophical goal, so to speak.
In your first phase of composition, where you worked with the new built instruments, pieces that have been finished until today, you were working a lot with electronic stuff also. I was talking to many composers also during preparing performances or something that were telling they were using electronic stuff for, you know, expanding the sound of an acoustic instrument. Was it this way you were thinking about composing these pieces, or was it more like you were looking like sound in general and searching for a specific sound, and by random it was like maybe found by an acoustic thing or electric thing?
If I may create a distinction, there's electronics, which is usually something which is there's a controller somewhere, maybe a computer, and there's electricity, and I'm really interested in electricity, but I worked a little bit with computers, and then I kind of consciously put it away because I think it takes a lot away from the performative situation. So I worked a lot with lights because of the electric circuit in the light and how you can transmit that circuit to the human body or to something else. And for me, these instruments was just a way of finding out how can I create something that you touch in a specific way so that choreographically or sonically, yeah, I can work with it in a certain way.
I recently performed your piece E, which is working with a huge amount of lights that are microphone amped and something like this. To have a view about the organizational life of a composer that has developed so many big instrument setups, how is it working? I mean, you're building the instrument, and of course you're selling your pieces through a publisher, and also you have to care about how does the instrument come to the place where the piece will be performed. How much time does it take for you to also have this maybe organizational part of your composer's life, because you developed all those instruments, and if the pieces get performed, you need to get the instruments there.
Yeah, there's a lot of organization and there's a lot of traveling. I prefer to travel with the instruments and then rehearse with the musicians, but it's not possible a lot. So you send the instruments to the group who wants to play, and you are in close dialogue, as close as possible even. We are in the rehearsal process, and hopefully people are able to send me maybe a video of a rehearsal, and then I comment and things.
And how about this idea of being part of the performance when the piece is getting performed, or working with the musicians? Is the problem that, of course, you have to travel a huge amount of time through the year, and you have also to work on new pieces, and you don't have the time? Or do you have the feeling the musicians maybe want to work on their own on pieces, or how is that about?
Well, there's a lot of economics, of course. I mean, to bring me to a certain place, you pay for travel, you pay for staying somehow, and it's a big strain on small ensemble's economy, which is, I very much understand. But it's also, of course, just very, for me, it's a big workload. If you do that every time you have a performance, I could not do that. So it's a compromise in many ways. Yeah. I'm trying to be more flexible about people just trusting people that they perform it the way that is most adequate.
At the end of every podcast talk, I ask everybody the same four questions. So, first one, is there something at the moment that, I mean, you were telling me you're at the moment trying to get some kind of holiday here in Copenhagen because so much of work and it's really hard to get some days off, but maybe there also is something that you are learning or practicing at the moment?
Some things that I'm learning. Maybe I'm trying to learn certain openings in chess that are really rare. This I like a lot. I have a book at home.
You play chess very often?
I do. I wouldn't say that I'm good, objectively speaking, but I like it a lot. Yeah.
Do you play with some chess partners, or do you play with the computer or on your own?
I mean, on a very lonely night, I might play online, but I like it a lot more to go to Blitz evening or something like this, to play 5 minutes. But I'm learning tango. Dancing, I think, is really my main interest, actually, right now, and has been for years. And I went to Argentina for 3 weeks recently to learn, as a complete beginner, to learn tango, and I'm taking tango lessons now. And I think my latest piece, I have this weird machine that can actually play, it can actually dance tango in a weird way. So that's something I'm learning. And I'm learning to play a piece of mine again that I have to perform in, which is, it's a teeth piece. You have to hear it through the teeth. I performed it many times, but it's a while ago, so I'm kind of relearning it.
Was it this piece? I saw a picture, I think, where also the audience as well as the performers are biting.
Yes.
Some kind of thing. How is about that?
It's a piece that explores extreme softness. So you play on these glockenspiel, and you play just by barely touching them with your fingertip, which is a wonderful kind of sine wave sound when you put your ear all the way down to the instrument. But if you amplify that and put it through loudspeakers, you make soft music louder. That's not my intention. I want to have the experience of putting your ear all the way down to the sound source. So I made this system where I send the music out through this wooden stick that everybody bites in, also the musicians. What happens then is that the music pretty much is realized in the vibrations of each person's skull, so it sounds like as if the music is just in front of you.
So it's like they have headphones on, they hear nothing, and it comes through the vibration of the teeth.
Yes.
What do you read at the moment?
I read a lot about animals. I read, of course, Donna Haraway, as everybody else.
I mean, that's a maybe interesting thing, because when you say you are researching about how becoming an animal or something, how is it like going inside this topic? I mean, what do you read about that?
Well, there's a body of work that deals with the Anthropocene at the moment, of course, in philosophy and also in novel, in fiction. So yeah, I read a lot about that in different places. I don't know. I also read about classical mechanics. I have a book about mechanics in Greece and in antiquity, because I have this very anti-technology kind of approach. I don't really think smartphones and computers, when it comes to music, is uninteresting. They close in on all the possibilities that you actually have if you are creative. So I'm interested. So I read about mechanics, classical mechanics, just water and strings and pulleys and whatever. And I read a lot of just, I read whatever, basically. I read a lot. I read novels, I read poems, I read weird books about weird things and that's, yeah.
Maybe you can recommend one weird book about one weird thing that I can put in the show notes.
What could that be? I read a novel by the guy who won the Nobel Prize. What's his Japanese name? I can never really say it. But it's called The Buried Giants. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. It's almost like a child book. Like it's like a fantasy kind of world. But I find it super beautiful. And weird things, I have this book called The History of Lions by a British, I guess he's an anthropologist, that just explores the concept of a lion in human society, which is, I also think, a wonderful, very abstract thing to go into. Just looking at a pavement, you realize how much your movement in the city is directed. We were sitting on the bench and it completely controls the angle of our backs, you know. So there's all these geometrical lines that control our body everywhere in space. And I find that interesting. Also music with notation is very much the same, I think. Reading is better than not reading.
Besides, I mean, the podcast is published on every possible podcast platform, but besides that, I created a playlist on Spotify. That every guest of the podcast may add one or two songs. So every listener of the podcast is able to hear also some of the favorite music pieces of the guests. Is there maybe some piece that you would like to add to the playlist?
I mean, everything that the early Umm Kulthum recorded, the Arabic diva, I adore absolutely. So Umm Kulthum, the early years of Umm Kulthum, I would say that's a given. Yeah.
Okay, we'll put something on the playlist for that. As you told, you were trying to get a bit of holiday at the moment, but as everybody who is like a freelance artist knows, it's really hard to get, I mean, you can't pause your thoughts and to get really off work and do something like absolutely holiday-like is really hard. And often you feel like coming home from a long day of working, performing, rehearsing, and you try to maybe get off of this working thinking to clear your head, to have some kind of rest, and don't think the whole time of your work and your future projects. Is there something like maybe some kind of ritual you do when you come home from such a long tour or day to clean your mind and to really have a relaxation time?
No, I don't have a ritual. I wish I had.
Okay. So thank you very much for taking so much time on your free day.
Yeah, sure.
I really appreciate the time with you. Have a nice time.
You too, Max.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Das war sie auch schon, die Podcast-Folge mit Simon Löffler aus Kopenhagen. Ich hoffe, ihr habt einen schönen Sommer. Wenn ihr Lust habt, postet doch gerne mal eine Story und verlinkt Weidesfeld, damit ich sehen kann, wo ihr so am liebsten im Sommer Podcast hört, ob in der Hängematte, am Strand oder im Schwimmbad. In die Shownotes von der heutigen Folge packe ich euch auf jeden Fall Simons Website. Da könnt ihr euch nochmal genauer über seine ganzen Stücke informieren. Und ich werde natürlich auch die Buchempfehlung und den Link zur Weidesfeld-Playlist bei Spotify reinkopieren. Die nächste Folge ist schon in Arbeit und wir hören uns wieder in 2 Wochen. Bis dahin habt eine gute Zeit. Ciao!